I'm Anthony Brooks, and for Robin Young, it's Here and Now. We're going to start today with a quick checkup on the nation's economy. A new report on jobs shows that the unemployment rate remains more or less stuck at 9.5%. That's the headline. Companies hired about 71,000 new workers in July, but overall the economy shed about 130,000 jobs. The government also said that in June, the private sector hired just 31,000 workers. And at that rate, the job market is actually losing ground. The jobs report comes as Fannie Mae, the mortgage lending giant seized by the federal government, offered its most positive earnings report in 2 years. Fannie is still losing money, but much less than it was. So a mixed report today on the economy. And we've asked Nariman Baravesh, chief economist with the economic forecasting firm IHS Global Insight, to give us his insight on this latest report. And Nariman, welcome. Explain this latest jobs report today. Can we still call this a recovery?
Well, if it is a recovery, and we think it is, it's a very, very sluggish one. I think the best way you can describe the improvement in the jobs market is glacial. It's moving very slowly. And as you said just a couple of minutes ago, yes, 71,000 jobs in the private sector is nowhere near enough to bring the unemployment rate down in any meaningful way. So we're looking at an economy that's essentially moving sideways. We don't think there's going to be a double dip, but on the other hand, this is a very, very weak recovery.
Some economists, among them New York Times columnist Paul Krugman, have been warning of the danger of the U.S. slipping into a long period of very weak growth and high unemployment, sort of like Japan's lost decade. Do you fear that? Is that what it seems? Does this seem like the beginnings of something like that?
The answer is no, we don't. And the big, big difference between our economy right now and Japan's in the 1990s when they went through the lost decade was the health of the corporate sector. Japan had a lot of zombie companies, you can call them that. We really don't have a lot. Well, you could argue maybe in the financial sector, less so in autos these days. But most of corporate America is in very, very good financial health. They're sitting on a mountain of cash. They're very profitable. The big question, the big debate, the big uncertainty is when are they going to start to spend? When are they going to open up their purse strings? They're very cautious right now. So I would not draw too close a parallel between us and Japan.
Well, you mentioned spending. Consumer spending still remains weak. And that's, I guess, a gauge of sort of public confidence in the economy. So to me, it looks like sort of a vicious circle. That is, people won't spend until they feel the economy improves. The economy won't improve until people start spending.
Now, that's a fair point, but I guess I'd see it a slightly different way, and that is that in the aftermath of a financial crisis, there is a fairly lengthy healing period. You know, we talk about deleveraging, people cutting down on their debt, and this is what consumers are doing. And the good news is that, you know, consumers are saving more. They're taking on less debt as a share of their income. Bad news is, you know, that process can slow economic growth down, but it actually sets the stage for decent growth, I would say, in about 6 months to a year. At some point, consumers won't save as much. At some point, businesses will start to spend. We can debate about sort of when that happens. I don't think there's any question about whether or not it will happen.
Now, the Federal Reserve is going to be meeting soon, thinking about ways to energize the economy. With interest rates at historic lows, what else can the Fed do to try to energize this recovery?
That's a very good question, and obviously they've been thinking a lot about it. Our best guess is that one of the things they're going to do is a lot of the investments, a lot of the instruments that they bought, these mortgage-backed securities, they come due, if you will. And if they do nothing, then basically the Fed's going to collect a lot of cash, if you will, and its cash will increase and its investment will diminish simply because they're maturing, if you will. We think that the Fed's going to actually reinvest that cash in more government securities, more mortgage-backed securities, in an attempt to put some more money back into the economy, make sure that they're not, without trying to, they're not implicitly tightening monetary policy. So I think that's the very first step they're going to take. But I think they've still got some ammo that they could use if the economy really looks like it is headed for a double dip, which we think is not likely. But still, you know, at least they've got the tools to deal with it if that happens.
Okay, Nariman, thank you so much. That's Nariman Baravesh, chief economist with the economic forecasting firm IHS Global Insight, talking about today's economic report. Our next story asks the question, just how broken is the U.S. Senate? And before we get into it, here's the latest news from that august body. As we've been reporting yesterday, the Senate confirmed Elena Kagan to the Supreme Court in a mostly party line vote. And there was a scene during the debate that illustrates some of what's gone wrong in the Senate. As Republican leader Mitch McConnell was voicing his opposition to Kagan, Al Franken, the Democrat from Minnesota who was presiding over the Senate, was audibly gasping, shaking his head and making faces. That prompted McConnell to reprimand him, saying, "This isn't Saturday Night Live, Al." In the New Yorker of this week, George Packer writes about the terrible partisanship and paralysis that now defines the U.S. Senate. His article is called "The Empty Chamber," and he joins us to talk about it. And George, first of all, I'm just wondering what your reaction is to the dust-up between McConnell and Franken.
I have to admit I'm a bit surprised, because for all the decline and decadence of the U.S. Senate today, and that is truly the theme of my piece in The New Yorker, there is still a veneer of decorum they all try to hold to, at least when they're in the Senate chamber or when, you know, they feel that people's eyes might be on them. I never saw anything quite like that. The presiding officer is usually quite deadpan and simply makes, you know, rulings and says and recognizes different senators. But the description is another broken taboo, I suppose, of many, many broken taboos in the Senate.
Of which you write about a number of them. I want to start here. You quote one senator, Michael Bennett, a Democrat from Colorado, who says, quote, "Sit and watch us for 7 days. You know what you'll see happening? Nothing." Well, George Packer, you did that. You watched the Senate in action for a while, or in action. Give us a sense of what it looks like today.
I actually tried to be there when things were happening, because I wanted to see the finale of the health care bill during the reconciliation vote in March. And I also watched the financial reform bill make its way to passage in April and May. And those have been some of the real high points of the past year and a half, and a sign that for all its dysfunction, the Senate has actually achieved things almost in spite of itself. Mm-hmm. But the norm in the Senate, especially in the chamber, is appallingly empty, as the title suggests. First of all, the chamber itself is usually empty. There's one senator giving prepared remarks written by staff that he hasn't read in advance. There's the presiding officer sitting up at the chair who might be scanning his BlackBerry while the senator is speaking. There might be another senator getting ready to give a speech and not listening. There's no press in the press gallery. There's a handful of visitors in the visitors gallery. And there's two stenographers standing next to the senator who's speaking, tapping away at these old-fashioned-looking machines slung around their necks. And they're the only ones who seem to be paying any attention to what's actually being said on the floor. So when you think of the Senate as deliberative, it's absolutely not true. It's a place where there's long pauses for quorum calls, where there's no real continuity of argument, where one senator gives a speech on one topic, another on a completely different one. There's almost never a back and forth between senators, and there's never, that I saw and that any senator could tell me, a moment when senators are actually engaging each other's points and maybe even changing each other's minds. That doesn't happen.
Well, what about that, George? I mean, this whole idea of debate in this august deliberative body, I mean, why do they even bother giving these speeches if they're prepared, as you say, by aides, they're not listening to each other? What is the purpose of even standing up there and delivering these speeches?
It's to have done it and to have it in the congressional record, have it on C-SPAN, and have it in their email press blast that they send out every few hours, telling their constituents who care and the Capitol Hill press what the senator just said. It's an echo chamber.
One of the problems you highlight in a big way are the Senate's arcane rules. You write a lot about the filibuster. You talk about the book that outlines Senate rules and procedures, that it's 1,600 pages long. I loved one example that I wanted you to talk about that I think illustrates the problem of these old rules, and that is this example that senators can put a hold on a nomination. We've all heard that. For whatever reason they want, a senator can essentially put a hold on a nomination, not allow it to go forward. But tell us about the origin of this rule of putting a hold on a nomination.
The hold goes back to the era of horse travel, when senators took several days to get from Tennessee or Ohio to Washington, and the hold was a courtesy to allow them the time to get back to study a bill or to talk to a nominee before casting their vote. And it's a great great example of how an old rule that made sense in its time has become a very modern weapon of the hyper-partisanship of today's Senate. Because now we have the spectacle of, for example, Senator Shelby of Alabama putting not just a hold, a secret hold, so that no one outside, a tiny handful of people in the Senate, knows even who is holding up these nominations on upwards of 70 nominees because he's upset with the White House over defense earmarks for Alabama. And that leaked out, and when it leaked out, he had to give a bit. But it's routine. And, you know, the Senate can't even fix its own most glaring problems. Two senators, Ron Wyden of Oregon and Chuck Grassley of Iowa, have been trying to get rid of the secret hold for years, since like 1997. How hard could it be? But they can't do it, because every time they get a bill passed as part of rules reform, the senators find a new loophole. The secret hold became the rolling hold, so that senators who were only allowed to have a secret hold for 2 or 3 days would then pass it to another secret senator who would have it held for 2 or 3 days and pass it back like a shell game. It reminds me a bit of Wall Street.
Yeah, in fact, I wanted to read this because you summed it up so well. I was struck by this line from your piece. Like investment bankers on Wall Street, senators these days direct much of their creative energy toward the manipulation of arcane rules and loopholes, scoring short-term successes while magnifying their institution's broader dysfunction.
There must be some broader social explanation, because it is a kind of betrayal of responsibility on the part of elites in different institutions. In the case of the Senate, the real prime cause of all of this is just super partisan politics, which the Senate was somewhat insulated from in its heyday in the 60s and early 70s, because there were coalitions on both wings. There were liberal coalitions and there were conservative coalitions across party lines. And there were also senators who had a belief in the institution, not in its arcane rules, but in making it work, in using it to address the country's problems. And that began to disappear in the late 70s and accelerated in the 90s and has reached an unbelievable depth today, although it could probably still sink farther. And you can chart that by the use of the filibuster, which was used as sparingly as once a year as late as the 60s. But now it's an everyday thing. It's as if the Constitution itself said this body requires 60 votes for anything to pass, which, of course, the Constitution doesn't say.
That's journalist George Packer. His article about the U.S. Senate, The Empty Chamber, appears in the current New Yorker. You can link to the article on our website, hereandnow.org. We'll be back with George Packer in a moment to ask, is there hope for reform in the Senate? And later in the show, how Mexico is reacting to Arizona's immigration law. Back after a break, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
And welcome back to our conversation with George Packer about the U.S. Senate. His article in the New Yorker is called The Empty Chamber, and it paints a portrait of an institution paralyzed by partisanship. George, despite this paralysis that you described, the Senate did get some major things accomplished this session: a big stimulus package, health care reform, financial regulation. Yesterday, they did confirm Elena Kagan to the Supreme Court. But you also point out there's a much longer list of things they didn't get done.
The House has passed 340-odd bills that have not even been able to be debated in the Senate, which is a source of great frustration to House Democrats. But it's true that not every bill in the House should come up in the Senate. The House passes a lot of stupid bills. There's a kind of paradox here. The Senate is at an all-time high of dysfunction and obstruction, and yet it has also achieved those three really landmark bills that you mentioned. But I think that it is already exhausted its ability to do historic things, and I feel that it's returning to a kind of stagnation that's more and more characterized the modern Senate.
And speaking of that stagnation and financial reform, you mentioned after financial reform was passed, Harry Reid announced the Senate wouldn't take up comprehensive energy reform and that that would join inaction on job creation, food safety, pilot training, veterans care, campaign finance, transportation security, labor law, mine safety, wildfire management, on and on and on. So as you conclude, you say you can feel the Senate slipping back into stagnant waters. It's really, really alarming what you write, I must say.
It's nothing new in a sense. What I didn't know and what a lot of readers seem not to have known is just the depth and degree of its rot. And that's why I needed 11,000 words in the New Yorker magazine to lay it out. It required a kind of demonstration by the accumulation of details, such as the detail that Claire McCaskill and Carl Levin couldn't hold committee meetings on defense issues, including one that had inconvenienced four star admirals and generals to come halfway around the world because the Republicans refused to give unanimous consent to waive an obscure rule that said you can't have committee hearings after 2 p.m. That's the kind of thing that drives senators crazy and that drives the conscious public crazy. You know, 100 of those little things brought home what the feeling of the place is.
And a big piece of that feeling, and you write about this really powerfully as well, you say when you spend 4 days in the Senate, it's easy to forget about everything else. And you talk about just how isolated the Senate feels. You talk about it, it feels like another country, and actual foreign countries in the Senate are unimaginable. The place remains insular, labyrinthine, and opaque, even physically. It's a really disturbing portrait of people who are supposed to be in touch with what's going on out in the country.
I mean, even the fact that the visitor's gallery is still called the men's gallery tells you something about how hidebound the place is. That's always been true. What used to be truer is that within that hidebound world, senators knew each other, cooperated with each other to some degree, and had a common purpose, which was to make the place function to the degree that it could. And there were always going to be Southern filibusters on civil rights and senators bringing pork back home, but nonetheless, there was a kind of basic understanding that for this place to be tolerable even, you had to cooperate, and that has stopped, and that's why the Senate, for a lot of senators today, is almost intolerable.
George, let me just throw this response to your piece from Mitch McConnell, the Republican Senate leader, in today's Washington Post. He said some of his best friends are Democrats. He cooperates with them and doesn't believe that the era of collegiality is dead at all. What do you think of that?
It reminds me of people saying some of my best friends are Jews. I mean, it doesn't sound quite right, does it? I mean, I don't believe it. I talk to senators about their friendships, about who they really know, and there are a few long-timers who have friendships across the aisle, like Kent Conrad and Judd Gregg, but increasingly it doesn't happen. And Mitch McConnell is the architect, and really the quite successful architect, of a strategy of obstruction, which has basically pressured his caucus into sticking together, even when it was against the wishes of individual members, in order to prevent the Democrats from scoring too many successes. That was his strategic advice at the start of this Senate session. You know, if we don't stick together, we will not be relevant. And there have been losses on his side. Olympia Snowe on health care early on, you know, Snowe Collins and Scott Brown on and Chuck Grassley on financial reform, but remarkably few. McConnell is a real party disciplinarian who, you know, through whatever means has been able to enforce it. And that has not made him at all popular with Democrats because they see him as empowering the most extreme members of his caucus. This is something Tom Harkin said to me. It used to be that the real obstructionists and extremists were a few senators who did not have the support of the leaders like Bob Dole or even Trent Lott. But in the Republican Party today, the more extreme views and the more obstructionist practices are coming from the leadership.
Well, finally, George, you spoke with several reform-minded freshman senators, and their perspective is interesting. How disappointed are they with the way the Senate operates, and what are their chances for actually making a change?
They're frustrated. Tom Udall, Michael Bennett, Jeff Merkley. I don't think the chances are very good, though, because they're not the majority of Democrats, let alone of the Senate. The Republicans will not accept any rules reform, I don't think, and a lot of senior Democrats. Chris Dodd recently said, you know, don't reform the filibuster. So the place, in a sense, may work for those who've been there a long time better than it does for those who arrived there thinking it would be something else, a place that actually solved problems. And they may start either quitting or becoming creatures of the place.
Mm. Well, it's a fascinating article. George Packer's article about the U.S. Senate is called The Empty Chamber. It appears in The New Yorker. There's a link at hereandnow.org. And George Packer, thanks so much for joining us today.
It was my pleasure, Anthony.
And Monday on Here and Now, cities across the country are trying to find ways to put people back to work. We'll look at an entrepreneurial boot camp in Detroit. Also, a story of interwoven lives, a mother whose Wellesley College-educated daughter was killed by the Taliban and the Afghan girl beaten by the Taliban who just graduated from Wellesley. That's Monday. News is next, Here and Now. Stormy weather today grounded helicopters carrying emergency supplies to northwest Pakistan, where the worst flooding in 100 years has left 1,600 people dead and millions homeless. Authorities are struggling to set up shelter and to reach people still stranded in remote areas. Earlier this week, we reported on concerns that radical jihadi groups might try to capitalize on the chaos. The BBC's Adam Minot reports on one organization that may be doing just that.
Four million people have been hit by this disaster. Not all have lost everything, but many hundreds of thousands have. They're homeless and for the most part helpless. Hosna Begum is living in a tattered tent measuring 8 feet by 12 feet with her husband and 10 children.
I cannot live like this. I lost everything when the flood came. My house is gone. My crops are destroyed. My cattle are dead. I need help.
Hosna Begum is getting some help, a little food and water, and if she or her children need it, medical care. Across the road from the camp, a relief operation was set up immediately after the flood. 300 local volunteers were put to work rescuing trapped villagers, and now they're helping anyone in need.
So what is striking is that in the midst of all the chaos immediately following the flood is how well organised this small relief operation here is being carried out. There are queues of people here, two queues queuing for medicine. In the last couple of minutes, an ambulance has arrived and they are now preparing to feed 30 or 40 people here on a carpet that's just been laid down. This is relief that is actually happening, relief that is not being done by the government.
From day first, only Palah-e Insaniyat and another organization, they were quite vibrant and active in rescuing people from the deep water, providing them some shelter and food essentials.
Mia Adil is the local head of Palah-e Insaniyat, a welfare group which operates in almost every corner of Pakistan. It is linked very closely to an organisation called Jamaat-ud-Dawah. After the bombing in November 2008 of the Taj Hotel in Mumbai, the attack was shown to have been carried out by Lashkar-e-Taiba, a militant Islamic group in Pakistan. Under huge pressure from the international community, Pakistan banned Lashkar-e-Taiba, reported to have close links with Al-Qaeda. The name disappeared, but the Lashkar-e-Taiba leadership and followers were not banned or arrested. They simply transferred to another organization, to Jamaat-ud-Dawah. So, in short, Palah-e Insaniyat, the organization here helping the flood victims, is closely linked to the jihadi group which carried out the Mumbai attack, suicide bombings and other atrocities. Mia Adil says he has no reason to fear being pursued by the police or security services in Pakistan.
Previously, all international community was putting huge, tremendous pressures on Jamaat-ud-Dawah and Hafiz Saeed, but nothing has been proven so far. And the Court of Justice in Pakistan has proved us fair and absolutely guiltless. So that's how we are here, and we are ready for any other combat if international community will sort it out against us.
Back in the camp, it's hardly surprising that Palah-e Insaniyat and by association, Jamaat Udawa is getting huge support from local people. Mohammed Kamran Khan, homeless and desperate, says he's not concerned by the jihadi links of the group. This is the organisation, virtually the only organisation, that has offered him and his family and friends any help at all.
We have no hopes from the government, but these people have truly earned the sympathies of the people.
A highly efficient hearts and minds operation is taking place in the midst of the misery of flood destruction and disease. This is not the active enlisting of future suicide bombers and jihadis, but it is a chillingly effective recruitment exercise.
And that report from the BBC's Adam Minot in northwest Pakistan. We'll be back in 30 seconds, here and now. When Arizona passed its tough and controversial illegal immigration law back in April, Mexico took notice. Mexican officials estimate that as many as 500,000 undocumented Mexicans live in Arizona, and they're bracing for a surge of deportees expected to return home. And even though a federal judge blocked key provisions of the new law from taking effect, making it less likely that illegal immigrants will be deported, the concerns are far from resolved, especially for Mexicans on both sides of the border. Joining us from Mexico City is Naja Catan. She's a writer for the Christian Science Monitor. And Naja, welcome.
Thank you.
Give us a sense of the mood there in Mexico. You've lived there for many years. What did you notice starting back in April when the first version of the Arizona law was passed?
I noticed that many Mexicans on the street that I'd interviewed were very angry about the law. There have been words thrown around like a racist law, xenophobic, fascist, you know, very extreme language, even after the injunction, because people see that this movement in the United States to try and curb immigration, it's not over. Mexico City's mayor, Marcelo Ebrard, said on Monday that there's a wave of xenophobia spreading through the United States. And immigration activist groups are still talking about holding forums and having press conferences to keep the issue on the table. But I wouldn't say it's a mass movement of protest, because when Mexico wants to protest something major, they know how to protest. They can hold mega marches of hundreds of thousands of people. That has not happened.
Naja, we mentioned that Mexican officials had been bracing for a surge of deportees expected to return home. I'm wondering what you've seen, if that's come to pass.
No, we haven't seen a mass exodus. There are even some federal immigration officials who acknowledge that it's probably not going to happen. I spoke with an immigration official in Sonora at the border of Arizona, Antonio Salas, and he said that all he's seen is a slight uptick in people coming in under a program that allows them to bring in their household goods and pay less taxes. He doesn't even know for sure if they're coming because of the Arizona law. So there's all this preparation, but there's also an acknowledgement that it might not be this mass exodus everyone's waiting for.
Mm. You mentioned Sonora, which is right on the border with Arizona. What's happening there? I understand they've been setting up shelters for a possible return of some of these deportees.
Right. They're boosting the number of shelters from 7 up to as much as 25. They've sent human rights observers to the border just in case many people are repatriated, to make sure that none of them have their rights violated. And the consulates in Arizona have beefed up their staff to handle any surge in the workload that they might have.
Now, there have been rumblings this week in the U.S. Congress about making changes to the 14th Amendment. That's the law that automatically grants U.S. citizenship to anyone born in the U.S., including children of undocumented immigrants. Some in the U.S. have accused Mexicans of abusing this law. What's been the reaction in Mexico to this discussion?
Well, it is just beginning to make headlines here in Mexico. The people I have asked about the debate have been horrified. You know, what they say is this is perhaps political revenge for the Arizona law not taking full effect. Some people say that the United States is a land of immigrants. How could they forget their roots? But again, not many people know about it yet.
Nahan, we understand that even though Arizona didn't end up enacting some of the toughest provisions of the new law, other states are trying to follow suit or at least having discussions about tough Arizona-style legislation. From where you sit down in Mexico, how does this kind of talk up north of the border resonate?
Well, I think it's part of the impression that this is not just one state and not just one law, but that it's a growing movement, not just other states, but people in the states who are supporting these efforts. You know, the public polls show that many people in these states are in support of those laws. So people say that the fight isn't over, even though the Arizona law was put on hold.
Before we let you go, I want to ask you just one last question. You've been reporting down there for 6 years, so you've been able to report on tensions between Mexico and the U.S. for some time. Are things as strained now as they've ever been in the 6 years you've been down there?
Well, I think that criticism of the United States is not new in Mexico. But again, the people I've interviewed on the street have expressed enormous anger. I mean, the people, you know, asking me specifically on the street, why are you doing this? It's very personal, I think. It's strange because on one hand, the U.S.-Mexico diplomatic relations are as strong as they've ever been. Obama supports the drug war 100%. He brought a lawsuit against the Arizona law. So on a diplomatic level, I think ties are very strong. But the Mexican public, they are not sure that their government is doing enough. Even though President Calderon has actually gone to the U.S. Congress in May and, you know, openly and harshly protested the law, they feel that there needs to be more constant voice and a stronger voice against what's happening in places like Arizona.
Well, Naka, thanks so much for talking to us today. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
That's Naka Katan. She writes for the Christian Science Monitor, reporting from Mexico City.
Yeah, election time's coming. Who you gonna vote for? Yeah, if I was president, I'd get elected.
And this is Wycliffe Jean singing If I Was President, which he recorded in 2004. Just a line from a pop song, right? Well, in fact, it turns out the Haitian-born hip-hop star has some serious political ambitions. This week, Wycliffe Jean declared that he's running for president of Haiti, joining a crowded field of candidates. Here he is last night on CNN.
I feel that me running, it brings a neutral situation, meaning that Wycliffe Jean can sit with any political party, have a conversation. I'm coming in neutral.
Jacqueline Charles, Caribbean correspondent for the Miami Herald, says the reaction from Haiti is enthusiastic, particularly among younger Haitians. But older leaders are more skeptical. And there are questions about whether Wycliffe Jean can even run. He's Haitian-born, but he moved to the U.S. when he was 9 years old, which may be at odds with Haitian constitutional requirements.
The Constitution requires that you cannot hold citizenship of any other country. Also, to run for president, you have to have lived in the country for 5 consecutive years.
So that's a problem. And while an electoral council looks into Wycliffe Jean's citizenship status, there are also other questions about alleged misdeeds at a charity he started for Haiti. Jacqueline Charles also says Wycliffe Jean's challenges don't end there, even if he were to win November's presidential election.
Here's a country, 10 million people approximately, 1.5 million under tents and tarps. And so how are you going to be able to govern? How are you going to be able to pull this country up from, you know, literally from the rubble?
That's the Miami Herald's Caribbean correspondent Jacqueline Charles reporting from Port-au-Prince. Back in a bit. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back. Today we have another great summer read for you. It's the true story of a larger-than-life character. It's a tale of golf, Depression-era Hollywood, and armed robbery starring John Montague, a man who could do amazing things. He could lift the actor Oliver Hardy, a good friend of his who weighed close to 300 pounds, up off the floor with one arm and place him on the bar. On the golf course, he could drive the golf ball farther than anyone else. But he had a dark secret that came back to haunt him. Former Boston Globe and Sports Illustrated writer Lee Montville uncovers this history in his book, The Mysterious Montague, A True Tale of Hollywood, Golf, and Armed Robbery. It's out in paperback now, and when I spoke to Lee Montville back in 2008, I asked him about one of the stories in the book, the day Montague beat Bing Crosby in a game of golf, playing with a rake, a shovel, and a baseball bat instead of golf clubs.
He played a lot with Bing Crosby, who was a very good golfer. And after one of these matches, Bing was in the lounge having a couple drinks and bemoaning his fate and saying that Montague was lucky. And Montague said, "Lucky?" He said, "I could beat you with a baseball bat, a shovel, and a rake." Crosby said, And Crosby should have known something was up when Montague went to his car and had a baseball bat, a shovel, and a rake in his car.
He was ready for him.
They went to the hole, which was about 400 yards or 350 or whatever, and Montague took the baseball bat and whacked the ball a good 320 into a sand trap up by the green. Crosby hit a normal drive, 240 maybe, and then an approach shot to within 20 feet of the pin, and then two-putted for the par four. Montague shoveled out the ball to within 8 feet and then got down on all fours and used the wrong end of the rake like a pool cue and put it in for the birdie. And that became his calling card, his famous thing. It got written up, and he was kind of asked to replicate that feat for the rest of his life.
Why does he fit so well into this era of Hollywood? I mean, it was sort of made for him, wasn't it?
Sure. It's the era of Hollywood that most of us would have liked to have seen, you know, smogless and free and everyone kind of charging off to make a fortune. It was the Depression. If you went not far from Hollywood, there were bread lines and all kinds of camps and, you know. But he fit in with the rich people, the entertainers, the guys that had kind of come across the country looking to make their mark, you know, actors who changed their names and directors and all those movie people who used to sell haberdashery in New York and now were the kings of movies. And it was a fast life, kind of alcohol-fueled and fun-fueled. They would play golf, then they would go into the Lakeside Golf Club men's lounge and drink and drink and drink, and somewhere 3 or 4 in the morning, someone would say, "Let's all go over to Catalina Island," and they'd all jump in cars and kind of weave to boats. And I mean, it must have been a fast and easy life.
So there is Montague hanging out with these people, Bing Crosby, Oliver Hardy, others, yet he has a secret. Nobody really knows where he comes from. Where did he come from?
He would never have his picture taken, never would enter tournaments, and never really talked much about where he got his money or anything, any of his background. And everyone kind of accepted that because it was somewhat normal in Hollywood to be from other circumstances. But as his reputation increased and as the stories got larger and larger, Time Magazine actually sent out a photographer, and he took a couple of pictures, and they ran it in Time Magazine. And way back in Jay, New York, up in the Adirondacks, a couple of state cops said, "There's the son of a gun, Laverne Moore, who we've been searching for 7 years, who was part of a group that held up the Hannah restaurant." There was a lot of circumstantial evidence, and the police came to his house 2 days after the robbery to talk to him. And his mother said, "Laverne is gone, and I don't know where he went."
He's arrested in Hollywood. They bring him back to New York for a sensational trial that fills the pages of all the newspapers. What happens next?
The robbery was in 1930. The trial was in 1937. And in 1930, it was in the midst of Prohibition, and booze was everywhere in the Adirondacks because they were taking alcohol from Canada, bringing it down to the thirsty citizens of New York City. The robbery was hooked up in that, and Montague, Laverne Moore, had been hooked up in that, too. 7 years later, Prohibition was gone, and everyone really didn't care that much. And the robbery had been for $700. And one of the robbers had died. There were four robbers, and one of them had died in the car chase afterwards, crashing the car. But it was kind of a small potatoes case, but it was built up by all of these Hollywood celebrities. Bing Crosby and Oliver Hardy had little sworn depositions or letters to the judge saying what a great guy John Montague was.
We should say that John Montague absolutely denied that he was involved in this robbery, even though there was all kinds of circumstantial evidence.
In the crashed car, they found his golf bag, his traveling bag filled with clothes. He said that he just left the stuff in the guy's car, and he didn't know what had happened.
So there's this circumstantial evidence. He takes off for 7 or 8 years. He changes his name. You would think this would be an open and shut case that he would be convicted.
Sounds like driving in a white Bronco, doesn't it? They have the trial, and the two robbers that had been apprehended served their jail time and now are out. They split. One of them said Montague was part of the crew. The other one said no, he wasn't. And Montague brought in his mother and two sisters to say that he was sleeping in bed the night of the robbery. The jury bought it. And the judge was so upset by the verdict, he kind of said thank you to the members of the jury, but you've given me the wrong verdict. I'm really ashamed of what you've done.
So after the trial, it was thought that he would become really famous and make lots of money now that he could play golf out in the open and become a star. But that didn't happen, did it?
No. I mean, there were guesstimates that he was going to make over $1 million in the first year, which would have been a lot of money in those days. And Bing Crosby was going to sign him to a movie contract. And now he'd be free to play in the U.S. Open and on the golf tour and exhibitions and all these other things. But he was now 35 years old. He hadn't played much golf for the last two years of his life. He'd gotten heavy, and it would have taken, I don't know, a lot of determination and pluck for him to kind of go back to basics and lose the weight and get back the 50 to 60 yards on the drives that had made him special and now he had lost. The other thing was the court of public opinion. Most people saw through the verdict and considered him guilty. The Hays Commission, which ruled movies, kind of put out a quiet fiat or something that said, we're not going to have this guy be in the movies. You know, it wouldn't be good for the morals of the youth of America. Mm. So the movie thing fell apart, and he never got it going golf-wise.
And he died alone in 1972 at the age of 69, I guess in a sort of derelict Fleabag hotel in Studio City, California. His body went unclaimed for a week. Hardly a fitting end for a guy who had enjoyed that kind of celebrity for a while.
The whole story is leaves you with a bunch of questions. You know, was he as good as Grantland Rice said he was? Could he, in his heyday, have been the greatest golfer? There was a little period in time there where Bobby Jones and Walter Hagen, the greats of the 20s, were off the scene, and like Sam Snead and Ben Hogan really hadn't come along, and he could have filled that void perfectly, but it never happened. And it's, I don't know, there's kind of a morality play here that you know you can screw up your whole life by doing one bad thing, and that's what happened.
That's Lee Montville. His book is The Mysterious Montague, a true tale of Hollywood golf and armed robbery. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Anthony Brooks. Robin Young will be back on Monday. Have a great weekend and join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.